Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Ann Law Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lowther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Ann Law Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today we've got a great guest. I'm talking about Paul Amato. I mean, if you're in the nuclear deterrence world, you know Paul. He's been around. You know, he was in OSDP as the director of the, you know, nuclear deterrence policy. You know, we all know Paul. I remember him. I've known him so long that whenever I first met him, he had lots of luscious blonde hair. He had blonde hair back in those days. He was a good racquetball player. We played racquetball together. It was a Marine Navy thing. Of course, I always won in those days. But, so we all know Paul. And, you know, Paul left the government not too long ago. And, you know, after you leave the government, you've got lots of things you want to say. So he's doing some writing. He's trying to figure, you know, get his feet wet in that space. And, of course, who doesn't want to be on a podcast, especially NucleCast? So, Paul, welcome to NucleCast.
Thanks, Adam. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you and look forward to chatting. You're already making some lighthearted comments, which make this a heck of a lot easier.
So from your many years in that office, in the Nuclear Deterrence Policy Office, you've worked for Republican administrations, Democrat administrations. You've seen the times when, you know, nuclear weapons were sort of on their way out the door. Then there was this, wait a second. And then now there seems to be sort of a, and you write about this in your most recent article, that there is a consensus forming that nuclear weapons actually matter and that we need to modernize the ones we have, replace the old ones, build new ones, and that we might actually need more. So from where you have, you know, where you've set in your career and sort of where you are now, what is it that you would want, you know, our listeners, you know, who are military, lab guys, contractors, all sorts of folks, what would you want them to know in terms of you bringing your decades of experience and now sort of joining the, you know, the graybeards crowd and starting to offer that sage advice that Frank and Madeline and others offer?
Well, so thank you for that question. And of course, there's a lot of different directions I could take the conversation. But I think over the last several years, there's this, as you mentioned, this convergence or this consensus in terms of the fact that, you know, we have a lot of challenges that we need to do things about. And when I say do things, it relates to the nuclear enterprise, it relates to posture, it relates to the size of the force, the type of the force, et cetera. But one of the challenges I see, and I've written about and I'm hoping to write a little bit more about, is the fact that nuclear deterrence continues to be, at least from my perspective, a relatively niche issue within the national security structure. And while, you know, many experts, you named several of them, have this perspective that, you know, we have a problem, we know what we need to do about it, we need to get busy doing something about it, the fact is the broader national security community, I don't know, is as attuned to the issues that we see and are trying to argue in favor of doing something about. In terms of like a point of departure for this conversation, that's something I think that needs to be, that people need to be aware of, because, you know, we continue to convince ourselves that we've figured this out and we need to do stuff about it, to use a very imprecise term. But I'm not sure that the ultimate decision makers, or at least a lot of the people who hold sway on some of the actual decisions, are as convinced as the nuclear community in general is.
You know, it's funny that you should say that, because it seems like in the, you know, and Keith Payne did a study of this, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago for the STRATCOM SAG, I think is who he did it for, where you know, he and the NIF folks looked at the number of articles written sort of that were anti-nuke and the number that were sort of pro-nuke. And it was about 6 anti-nuke articles for every 1 pro-nuke article. And so, you know, just sort of in the press coverage, we, you know, take a beating pretty consistently. And if it weren't for the fact that, you know, reality always trumps idealism, you know, we might be faring far worse than we are. But, you know, it's this fact. And then it's, you know, like, I forget her name. She's the lady that wrote the new book that has sort of this ridiculous nuclear scenario. And, you know, it's, and for guys like you and me, we're sitting there looking at it going, this is not how it would actually happen. This is not how we operate. But, you know, she's on every podcast and she gets to spread a message that is just absolutely false. And so it's very hard to actually get accurate information to people who matter when there's so much disinformation and misinformation out there. Right. Do you have a solution for that? Because that's really what we need is a solution.
Right, right. Well, you know, it's somewhat of an age-old problem, right? It's hard to argue that nuclear weapons are good. We need nuclear weapons because that immediately creates a reaction in those who are not, you know, familiar with these issues as much as you or others from the, you know, expert community. And so I think as opposed to, you know, the non-proliferation or arms control communities, which are going to come at these issues, you know, from a particular perspective, and it's hard to kind of sway them, you know, for the national security community who's not steeped in nuclear issues, I think it's important to explain to them as best we can as to why this is important for them. Again, you know, at the end of the day, we need a military that is able to accomplish things in all of the relevant domains, whether it's conventional, space, cyber, et cetera. And so I don't want to necessarily bias nuclear over all the others. At the same time, if those strategists or planners are made aware of the risk of escalation and how China, Russia are both thinking about nuclear in their broader strategy, but also the capabilities that they have in their strategy, they may come to realize that, well, nuclear isn't this weird niche thing that's off in the, you know, kind of the attic. It's something that they need to be thinking about from the beginning of their strategy development to avoid kind of that, those, you know, those unfounded worries or unfounded fears. As far as the public is concerned, I mean, certainly this doesn't seem to be an issue that catches a lot of attention. I don't think it's good that the public isn't cognizant of the risks associated with, you know, potential nuclear escalation or nuclear war. Certainly they're more at the forefront today than they were, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, given what's happening in Ukraine and the, you know, the rhetoric and actions that we see from Russia. But at the end of the day, you know, this eventually all comes down to trade-offs. And I think that, you know, it's best that we make sure that the most senior leadership in the government have the opportunity to understand the risks so that when they make trade-offs, they're making the best trade-offs for our security, our posture, our set of capabilities.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've, and you tell me if you agree or disagree, but I've long thought that I'll see, you know, Air Force generals, for example, get up on a stage to talk about nuclear weapons and I'll say something to the effect of, well, if I could uninvent them, I would. But we can't. The genie's out of the bag. So therefore, and I think you undermine your argument with that very first statement. Because in reality, at least for me, I would never uninvent nuclear weapons. Because I know what a world without nuclear weapons looks like. It looks like 100 million dead in World War II, 50 million dead in World War I, the rise of the Soviet Union, the rise of communist China as post-war effects. I don't want that world. So how do we get our own people that are actually within the nuclear community to talk about nuclear deterrence and sort of lay out the case in an effective, persuasive way, when oftentimes they undermine their argument with their first statement.
Right, right. It's like a grudging acceptance of the need for nuclear weapons. What's interesting, and I will answer your question, but a little bit of a detour in doing so. You'll probably recall the 2014 Nuclear Enterprise Review. This came about after the ICBM officer cheating scandal, and there was something similar that happened with the Navy. And so there was both an internal and an external review. The internal review, which was conducted, actually Madeleine Creedon was involved in that, Greg Weaver and other notable individuals, is classified. So, of course, can't speak about that here. But the external review was unclassified. And it actually came up with a phrase that we've used for many years thereafter, a say-do gap between what national leadership or senior leadership said about the importance of the mission versus what actually happened on the ground with the airmen who were turning wrenches in the missile fields, or the sailors who were under-resourced in certain cases. And so I think part of that is a mindset that came from the post-Cold War kind of nuclear holiday where we weren't focused on these things. Partly it was, I think, a function of the messaging that came out of the Obama administration. Not that, the president can't chart a course that he, felt was important at the time, but, the idea that, we want a world without nuclear weapons and we want to reduce the role of nuclear weapons, it devalued what those airmen, sailors, et cetera, were doing. And so finding a balance where we're saying how important and maintaining how important the mission is versus, a desire to try to make sure we take whatever steps we can to reduce the risk of, nuclear war and nuclear, escalation is a good thing. So I think a lot of it, frankly, comes down to education, because I still see, up until the point I left, I still see ignorance or saw ignorance about, some of the basics of nuclear deterrence among senior leadership, both civilian and military. And when I say education, it really is in some respects similar to what the Biden administration was trying to do in 2022 with their national defense strategy, where they were attempting to establish what they called integrated deterrence, and then combine the nuclear posture review, the missile defense review, and the national defense strategy in a way to try to bring them all together. Well, that was a first effort, and I think it was good as far as it went. But there needs to be more done to try to bring together the nuclear and non-nuclear communities in ways that the folks who are focused on conventional warfare and or perhaps non-nuclear warfare are, aware of the capabilities, strategy, intent, and capabilities of a Russia or a China, and recognize how those capabilities can be brought to bear, probably in ways that they didn't think about 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. And again, a lot of this wasn't actually included in training to our military folks, whether it's junior officers or in the most senior officers, or if it was like a class, or a presentation. And so there just needs to be a recognition that this is, really something we need to pay attention to. The piece I'm working on right now, I have a line in there that talks about the fact that, all the conventional forces in the world, no matter how good they are, the extent, the quality, the capabilities of them, aren't going to do you much good if the adversary thinks that they have a pathway to victory through nuclear escalation. And so what we want to try to do is eliminate that pathway, or at least deter them from pursuing that pathway. And conventional strategists need to understand that just as much as nuclear strategists need to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember, I don't know, it was maybe 2020-ish, 2018, something like that. And General Milley was the chief of staff of the Army at the time. And he went and testified before Congress about why he was asked, should we be modernizing the nuclear force as the chief of staff of the Army? And he gave what is perhaps one of the best answers that I had ever heard, which, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, he said something to the effect of, well, our nation's nuclear arsenal allows me to wage war in places like Iraq and Afghanistan without concern that our adversaries will employ nuclear weapons against us. And, you know, so he was able to, at least in that instance, to bring it to what is essentially a conventional force in a conventional fight. And it would be kind of nice to, this kind of gets back to your point, if others sort of had that at least fundamental understanding of how nuclear weapons can enable conventional forces to, you know, be the best in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I mean, that's a great statement and it's very interesting. What jumps out at me about it though, is that that's coming from General Milley when he was in the Army as opposed to the chairman. Right. And yep. So, you know, the Army doesn't have a nuclear mission. So his resourcing as a leader in the Army wasn't necessarily at risk. And one of the challenges we have with the Navy and the Air Force, of course, is the nuclear capabilities are in competition with the non-nuclear capabilities. And, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say those aren't important. But at the end of the day, you know, they're being forced to make trade-offs that are really, really difficult for them, they being the Air Force and the Navy. And again, to one of my earlier points, typically from my experience, and again, this is at the GS-15 director level, but typically it's the A8 or the N8 that is sitting in these budget meetings. It's not the nuclear deterrence experts. And so, you know, a lot of those kind of resourcing decisions, number one, are in competition within the Air Force and the Navy. And then number two, they're being led by non-nuclear experts or, you know, acquisition experts or budgeting experts, not necessarily nuclear experts. So I'm not saying that that's something untoward or you know, inappropriate. At the same time, you know, you kind of come at issues based on where you're coming from. And so the nuclear community in those venues tends to have to be at a little bit of a disadvantage. So it really requires the most senior leaders to kind of like force the subordinates to, you know, to think through, you know, those trade-offs so that we're just not making them inadvisedly.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrent Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. Yeah, I wonder, you know, when we think about, you know, nuclear leadership, if you think about the Air Force, for example, and, you know, the last time a nuclear-enabled, you know, officer was the Air Force Chief of Staff. You know, it's been 25 years or more. And we've had one, you know, Sevy Wilson was the Vice Chief. And, you know, it's been announced that General Bussier will be the, you know, the next Vice Chief. But, you know, you were a bomber, sort of a bomber-led force for, you know, much of the Cold War. And then near the end of the Cold War and subsequently, it's largely been a fighter-led force. And I wonder, you know, that's had a major impact. You could say similar things about the Navy in terms of, if you look at, you know, CNOs, when was the last time a nuclear officer was the CNO? And I mean, I can't think in my recent memory when that was. And, you know, it's the same, you could say the same thing about the Army. And so I just wonder if you don't have senior leaders that are in your, you know, sort of your nuclear forces, you know, in the Navy, they're kind of squirreled away. They do their own thing. They're kind of totally separate. In the Air Force, you've got Global Strike Command, and Global Strike Command is always in a knife fight with ACC. And, you know, how are you ever going to get to the point where you sort of have that senior level support that doesn't wane?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so look, I was in policy, in OSD policy, and so I want to tread a little bit carefully about talking about how the services should comport themselves. I think that you know, you learned through your experience in the military, I'm sure, and I certainly learned that, you know, personal leadership is critical to achieving the things that a leader wants to achieve. I mean, if you know, what you inspect is what people pay attention to, type of thing. And so I'm not sure where that leadership must come from. I mean, it could come from the president. It could come from the Secretary of Defense. It could come from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It could come from the service chiefs. But at the end of the day, you know, the services are being asked to do more with less, or at least with the same amount. And so, you know, it's hard to fault anyone for making those kind of difficult decisions. At the same time, though, as you know, and as many in our community know, the risk of nuclear escalation in coming out of a conventional fight is becoming more, I won't say likely, but, you know, the risks of it are increasing. And as a result, we need to be paying attention to it. So I think, you know, should leaders be made to understand through education, through advocacy, you know, the possibility exists that they'll realize, well, maybe the next incremental dollar should be spent on it, on something that's slightly different than what we were hoping or would wish to spend it on. But it's, you know, it's hard for me, from my perspective, to be able to say the Navy should do this or the Air Force should do that, because they're in some respects being put on the horns of dilemma themselves. So again, I think the angle I'm taking is that to the degree people are actually educated to the risks, that you could have the most exquisite conventional capabilities in the world, but if the adversary can escalate its way out of that that, you know, box we put them in, then it kind of defeats the whole purpose. And then, of course, the conventional warfighter won't be able to achieve his or her you know, conventional war objectives, OPLAN objectives. And so, you know, what we want to do is keep a lid on this stuff. And by doing that, when I say stuff, I meant escalation. In order to do that, we need a set of capabilities that makes the adversary think that this isn't the way I want to go. And, you know, one of the comments I make in my piece that you mentioned earlier, you know, that's not necessarily the force we have today. And even once the modernized force is fielded, it's not necessarily the force we'll have at that point. And so people need to understand that. And if at the end of the day, we as a nation, or we as a Department of Defense, choose to accept risk in those areas, you know, that's what they get paid to do. But I think one of the problems or one of the challenges is I'm not certain that they're aware of those risks in the way I feel like I personally feel like they should be.
Yeah, and you mentioned that, and so I immediately think of the kind of war, if I were the Russians or the Chinese, I would fight against the Americans. And I would employ low-yield tactical nuclear weapons, because that's where I think I can, you know, escalate to de-escalate. I can escalate to force escalation to capitulation, and where I know the Americans really can't climb the rung with me. How did we get to a point to where we essentially took ourselves out of the game as it regards, you know, theater nuclear warfighting, or, you know, tactical, whatever terminology you may want to use? We've essentially said, well, we're only going to have strategic nuclear forces that defend the homeland, and all war is going to be strategic nuclear war, where our adversaries don't think that.
Yeah.
How do we get ourselves in that situation?
Well, I mean, there's many, you know, many authors who've written about that in great detail. But I think from my perspective, you know, what I saw and observed and dealt with through two nuclear posture reviews is kind of like I said earlier, like a nuclear holiday, a post-Cold War. It was kind of, I'll say, supercharged, if you would, by the messaging from the first or from the Obama administration in terms of the Prague agenda, the desire to reduce the role of nuclear weapons, you know, the ideas influenced through the Global Zero movement, this idea that we were kind of post-history, that you know, great power war was behind us. Russia was either a friend or at least not an enemy, and there was no other one on the horizon who could you know, confront the United States and threaten us. Well, you know, I've long believe that, you know, there's always going to be a bully in the neighborhood. And I think despite our most desirous efforts, there's always going to be someone who's going to try to take advantage of, you know, a particular situation. And Russia has done that. They did it in 2015. 2014 and 2015, and of course they're doing it with regard to Ukraine. So all that said, you know, we didn't necessarily see that threat as it was latent, and then it continued to grow. And then by the time it grew, you know, we had become, you know, our muscles had become weakened, you know, had become flaccid in terms of our ability to build nuclear weapons, to grow the force. And so in some respects, this is just, you know, our view, the United States view, that we didn't really have a peer that we needed to worry about. And so all of that capability atrophied. And with it came the mindset. The mindset or the intellectual rigor associated with nuclear weapons that atrophied. And so now we're playing catch up. But of course we're playing catch up but we're also playing catch up in the sense that we're trying to do everything in, you know, within a 10-year period of time, give or take. And that's very, very hard to do for the nuclear enterprise, for the military services. But again, I think it's just this kind of this hangover, if you would, from the, you know, like I said earlier, the nuclear holiday, as amplified by some of the rhetoric and appropriate desires out of, you know, the presidential administration at the time, but maybe in retrospect, short-sighted.
Yeah. Now, we're at that time in NucleCast where I like to bring out Bob the Genie. And as I rub my magic lamp, Bob grants all guests 3 wishes, but only on the topics we've discussed. So no great wealth. You can't wish for those luscious blonde locks back. So, you know, let me ask you, Paul, what is your first wish?
So, you know, I think that the nation faces a, you know, incredible challenge. And I address this in my paper in terms of, like, the capabilities that we have today versus the capabilities that we need versus the threats that we face. So, you know, if I were king for the day, or if it was actually true that I could get a wish, I think I would wish for more budgetary top line, not just something through a reconciliation bill that we saw most recently with the administration and the One Big Beautiful Bill, but actual long-term, consistent funding for an increase in the capabilities that we need. Commenting on that in 2 ways. Number one, I think, and I would love somebody to do this study, I'm not the person to do it, but to see actually our return on investment from our nuclear investments in the 80s. You know, at the time they probably seemed pretty excessive, but if you were to amortize that over the life of the capabilities that we have, I would imagine it would actually be a pretty decent bargain. And I think that idea here for the current modernization program and what we maybe need might seem on its face like it's very expensive, but if you amortize that over the life of those systems, it might actually be pretty inexpensive. And then the second piece is back to my first point. You know, Secretary Mattis said, you know, it may be expensive, but the cost of a nuclear war is more expensive. And, sure. I think that, you know, weighing the risk is an important thing that military strategists, planners, budgeteers do. But I don't know that full picture is actually being accounted for. And so by having additional top line, it kind of eases that challenge. Yeah. So that's one wish. Do you want me to go through all 3, or is that
good? Yeah, of course. And then I've got one that I want to ask. If you don't wish for this one, I've never had anybody wish for it, and I'm going to get you to tell me why they don't wish for it. Unless you wish for it, then we're covered.
Yeah.
So wish number 2.
Wish number 2 is a recognition that the war fight in Europe would be very different from the war fight in the Pacific. And I realize that at a conventional level, people understand that the distinction between, you know, an air and sea war in the Indo-Pacific versus a land and air war in Europe. But to the extent that we need non-strategic nuclear weapons, and I believe we do need to enhance our capabilities in this respect, a recognition that, well, just because we have some additional B-61s, we could move over to the Indo-Pacific, that doesn't necessarily solve the problem. We need capabilities that are able to be tailored to not just the adversary, but the environment that we're going to be in. And so, you know, we are pursuing SLICM, and I say we're pursuing it because Congress has basically mandated the sea-launched cruise missile, the nuclear sea-launched cruise missile. But I'm not sure that even that capability is particularly suited for the potential fight we would have in the Indo-Pacific. So I think, you know, my second wish would be, number one, a recognition that we have a different warfight in the Indo-Pacific, and that we'll need a different set of capabilities than what we currently have in order to be able to maintain deterrence or, if needed, you know, restore deterrence.
Yep. Okay, that's another good wish number two. Now you're down to your last one.
Yeah. So I think that my last one is, I think it's kind of all, they're all tied together to some degree, but I have long argued that, you know, a nuclear weapon isn't a nuclear weapon isn't a nuclear weapon. I think a lot of the people in the non-nuclear community hear nuclear and they think, well, we got, you know, 1,550 nuclear weapons. Why do we need more? Without a recognition that the different sets of capabilities, different attributes are necessary to have, you know, a stable deterrence posture. And so there's a lot of reasons why we need more versus fewer nuclear weapons. And it's not just because I think we just need more because we need more. It's because the sets of capabilities bring particular attributes that make a particular weapon system or delivery platform more or less suited for the mission you're trying to achieve. And so to have people recognize that numbers by themselves aren't the only answer to the question, but that the quality of the capabilities and the attributes is important, I think that would be a wish, is for people to understand that. And I'll just add in that regard why I feel it's important. And this is something people have heard me say before. You know, at the point of decision, when the president, whether it's President Trump or a subsequent president, is forced to try to decide how to restore deterrence after an adversary uses nuclear weapons, you want to provide him as much optionality and flexibility as possible. And if you tell him something like, and this isn't an exact scenario, but something like, well, Mr. President, we can get a B-52 there with an ALCM in 12 hours or 18 hours or something along those lines, you know, I think he will turn to you and say, you know, are you kidding me? That's our only option. Now, again, that's a completely arbitrary and false scenario. But the point being, you want to be able to present the president as much optionality and flexibility as you can, because at the end of the day, he or she one day is the one who's going to be trying their utmost to restore deterrence and prevent a general nuclear exchange from happening. And the more tools we have available for him or her, the more likely they'll be able to make wise decisions that don't, you know, create, you know, like I said, a general nuclear exchange. So that like understanding and education, I think, would be my third wish.
Yeah, that's a good one. Those are all. I'll talk to Bob offline and see if he can't make those happen. Those are three good wishes. Now, the one that I've never gotten anybody to, you know, to ask is, I've long wanted sort of a base zero study to where we say, well, if we're not taking into account what we've built over the last three generations of nuclear weapons, what would we build today?
Yeah.
And we've never had that study. I don't even think a think tank has ever done that study. And I've long wondered why we haven't ever just started from scratch and said, what would we build if we were starting from scratch? And then come up with what that arsenal looks like.
Yeah. So that's actually a really interesting question. But let me ask you a question in the way you phrased it. What would we need in terms of like the capabilities, or what we need in terms of numbers? Or both?
Would you put them in space? Would you build lots of ICBMs or all hypersonics, or you know, would they be drones? Like I wrote an article like almost 20 years ago, and I said, take the Army's UCAS that they were flying off of the decks of carriers and put a B-61 on it. And then fly it over whatever country in a hard target and, you know, let it do that. So, you know, there's lots of creative ways you can, you know, deploy nuclear weapons and employ them. And so I wonder why we don't ever just sort of be what we are as Americans, which is creative, and really make it difficult for adversaries.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the thoughts I've had over time, and again, this has never manifested in actual, policy work, but, you know, is the successor to Columbia, is the successor to B-21, is the successor to Sentinel another like
exactly,
or should it be something completely different? And, you know, at some point there's going to be a nuclear posture review, hopefully, where they are taking up those issues. Because to your point, and this is another piece that's rattling around in my brain, the risks to the various legs of the triad, I think, you know, are multiplying. And you know, as we start to make some hard decisions about how many Columbias we purchase, you know, whether we de-emphasize ICBMs because of the cost of Sentinel, whether we buy more B-21s, you know, there's a certain balance between the three, or among the three legs of the triad today. But as we face some of these fiscal constraints, 5 or 10 or 15 years from now, as the threats, kind of these advanced capabilities emerge, will we find out we put too many eggs in one of the three baskets, and will we regret it? And so the type of thinking you're talking about, I think, is valuable. But the problem is we need to deliver what we have first before we can start thinking about, you know, what's next. And, you know, I think we're still kind of struggling to be able to do that.
Yeah, we're in a heck of a spot. Although I'm hoping, you know, in 1960 we were building, you know, one missile silo every 3 days. Yeah. So I'm hoping we can get back to that.
Well, so, I'm with you on that. I know that they're having a lot of challenges thinking through that, but hopefully they're kind of taking, you know, we would say they're taking a knee and facing outward to some degree to try to figure out how they increase the pace of construction.
Absolutely. All right. Well, unfortunately, Paul, we are out of time. So thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And, you know, I look forward to staying in touch and hearing some of your other guests in the coming weeks and months.
All right. Well, me too. They're always great guests. I mean, you're one of many fantastic guests we have on NucleCast. So thanks for being here. And of course, as always, we want to thank you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of NucleCast, and we will see you next time. Well, it was good to chat with Paul, you know, over the years working with him on various things and, you know, interacting periodically, you know, now that he's left government, has the opportunity to sort of reflect and, you know, you get to say things you wouldn't have, you know, previously been able to say because you had a boss. And so it's, you know, it's good to see. And it's always interesting to hear, you know, what folks like Paul have, what they're thinking about now that they can sort of reflect. And, you know, education was kind of the focus of what he thought was really important. And so that's really something we should work on.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krunkel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it, and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter @NucleCast.